Welcome to the Land Jam Podcast, a semi-friendly discussion between two blokes on watches, cars, and everything in between. Now, here are your hosts, Tommy and Sanjeev.
Welcome to a Land Jam Short, the Integrated Bracelet Mania.
Yeah, this is a pretty much a Marmite kind of story here, Sanj. I don't know. What are your thoughts on integrated bracelets? Are you a fan? Is this something that you avoid like the plague? It's very 70s.
It is very 70s. I think for integrated bracelets, it needs to fit the character of the watch. You know, like I've seen like a few watches where, you know, they can, you know, you can throw out the bracelet and add a NATO or whatever, a different strap or bracelet design, but you can't because it's integrated. You know, I think some of the Orises are like that.
Yeah, I think if memory serves me right, the Oris Aquis,
yeah,
I think is integrated bracelet. Yeah, I mean, they can get pretty annoying with the proprietary ways to attach a strap or a rubber bracelet.
But there's some that are, you know, that is very fitting to the character of the watch. You know, like I may be jumping ahead, but like say like the Royal Oak, the AP Royal Oak.
Yeah. So the first article I was going to mention was a Gear Patrol article on it was basically from 2 years ago saying the integrated watch bracelet deserves a comeback. And they were kind of prescient because right now the integrated watch bracelet is kind of having a renaissance moment. It is kind of coming back. Looking back at the history, you know, they really point to the Genta design for the Audemars Piguet Royal Oak, and of course his rival design at Patek, the Nautilus, which both had integrated bracelets, and really kind of kicked off an era in the 70s where, you know, this became kind of a design trope that a lot of companies did. Seiko did one, Seiko did a couple models, Tissot had one as well, which we're going to talk about later. And, you know, it's still with us today. I mean, some of the Zin models have basically a bracelet built right onto the case.
You know, yes.
It's that same design language still continues, right? So even the Porsche Orfina, the Top Gun chronograph has, it's a lugless design. And I kind of like it.
Yeah.
I mean, they're very, very retro.
Exactly. Right? I mean, some of these watch designs, you know, you kind of want to stick with the integrated bracelet. Because it really captures the, you know, completes the look of the watch.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much a 70s, 80s thing. But the weird thing is, you know, the interesting thing is that in the watch world, right, obviously we're having a retro watch moment. And the retro watch really, you know, the definition is a 1960s watch, right? But we're 10 years into this retro watch moment, right? So, you know, the retro watch is now reaching the 1970s.
Yeah.
So a lot of those weird designs that, you know, the 1970s, you know, made popular is now becoming, you know, in vogue again. So,
yeah, I mean, especially cases, yeah. You know, I mean, not just bracelets, but like cases too, like, you know, the bullheads. I guess the bullheads came in like the late 60s, early 70s. But, you know, like some of the cushion cases and the really fat, odd looking, highly brushed cases, really interesting stuff.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting how kind of the idea of retro has advanced over time, and I don't know, it's kind of exciting because, you know, there were a lot of cool watches in the 70s.
Yeah,
you know, it was a weird time, a lot of bright colors, a lot of weird designs. But yeah, maybe, you know, maybe we're gonna get a renaissance of new designs because I think, you know, it gets old sometimes looking at retro watches that are all from the same couple of years, who are kind of bouncing around the same ideas.
Right.
So, you know, this could be an interesting little trend that could pick up again.
Yeah, and I think with these, you know, integrated bracelet watches, you know, and especially like I would say the 70s in general, it was less on the polishing and more on like the brushed look, you know, a bit more industrial, brutalist kind of thing.
Yes. Yeah, I agree on the industrial and brutalist take on things. It was not so much refined as much more as like a modernist take on things. Like the Patek Philippe Nautilus, right? I mean, it's a Patek Philippe, but It's a Patek Philippe unlike any other Patek.
Exactly. And imagine, you know, this is one company that was designing very classical, highly polished, you know, finishing kind of watch. And then they, you know, busted out a highly brushed stainless steel watch, you know, like it was just extremely polarizing. But
is the Patek Philippe now out of stock? Have they stopped making the steel Patek Philippe? Is that
That's
true?
What I have heard as well. And, you know, we might need to refer to the listeners here, but it sounds like Patek has ended the Nautilus production in stainless steel. And like the secondhand market has gone crazy with the retail price, you know, with the pricing in the secondhand market. It's incredible. You know, these watches sell already for an expensive 30 grand. And
it's insane.
Yeah, and then they go on the secondhand market for triple the value.
So yeah, it seems like the reference 5711 has been discontinued, which is the steel Nautilus. If I'm getting anything wrong, definitely let us know, because this is not our wheelhouse. But
I mean, you still have the Royal Oak.
You still have the Royal Oak. Yeah, I mean, what is Audemars Piguet without the Royal Oak?
True. I mean, I would like to say, I mean, AP was, you know, I guess a bit more of the classical. This is just my take on it. And then, you know, when things got tough and with the whole quartz crisis and everything, and then Genta arrived and brought out the Royal Oak, which basically, you know, changed the direction of the company forever. You know, the Royal Oak was a phenomenal hit.
I mean, what else? I'm going to feign ignorance here, but what else did they make? I really don't know. Do you know any models?
Don't they make like the Jules Verne or something like that? They have the recent one, which is Codes, I guess.
I'm looking at the website. All right, so you've got the Royal Oak, Offshore, the Royal Oak Concept. Yeah, there's a Jules Audemars Hot, yeah, Classique Millenary. Let me tell you right now, okay? It's the Royal Oak, all right? No one is walking in looking at some of these other weird watches. They're coming from
right,
Royal Oak.
But I mean,
let's be real.
Right, but what I'm trying to say is like the Royal Oak is just being like a game changer for the company, right?
Oh, for sure. I don't think the company would be around without it.
And you know, the same can be said for, in to a lesser degree, with Patek, you know?
Yeah.
The first thing that comes to people's mind nowadays for Patek is the Nautilus.
Which shocks me that they're getting rid of the steel Nautilus. It really, I don't
know. I think they're going to bring it back, you know, upgraded and everything. You know, Patek, you know, these people are not, you know, crazy to just end production of one without any reason, right? You know, they're probably working on a successor in some form. And, you know, that will probably drive up demand because people are probably going to hanker for a Patek. They're probably playing the Rolex playbook.
Yeah, but Rolex never pulled out the Submariner. They didn't stop the Submariner for a while. The steel Submariner. You could always get a steel Submariner. I mean, there's a waiting list, and you may pay more for it.
True.
It exists, right? To pull out your steel flagship model that's interesting. Yeah, like I said, this is not a part of the market we know much of anything about.
Yeah, I mean, you just went on the website to figure out what the other is.
Exactly. I have no idea.
I'm just throwing out
random. It's not a brand I really care about.
That I like, I tie in with children's storybooks. So, I mean, I don't know what I'm talking about.
But what we do know about is integrated bracelets. And two watches that actually are following this trend. One of them is actually from Citizen, okay, which should be surprising for you because it's surprising to me. And it's the Citizen, Okay, the name of the watch is the Citizen.
This is what, like the Ferrari LaFerrari?
It's the Citizen by Citizen. It's pretty interesting. It's a high-end three-hander. Actually, I should correct myself when I say that. It is technically a three-hander, but it's a sub-second style. So there's not a chronograph, it's not a complication heavy watch at all. Okay. And they're selling it for $6,000.
This is a Citizen for $6,000?
$6,000. Now let me tell you why. Okay. So Citizen has, acquired a Swiss movement manufacturer called Le Jeu Perret. And they used to make calibers for Armin Strom, Hublot, Tag Heuer. They had a kind of a tie-in with Arnold and Son, even before Citizen. So these were high-end movement makers. And basically what they've done is they've had a joint project between Citizen and La Jupereau to develop the caliber 0200. And the engineering was done by Citizen, okay, to get this caliber up to speed. And Le Jus was doing really a lot of the finishing. But the interesting thing about the 0200 caliber is that Citizen's touting it as having above chronometer standard accuracy. So something along the lines of -3 to +5 seconds per day.
Which is impressive, right? For a mechanical watch.
Which is pretty impressive. Yeah, I mean, I think as of now, Citizen has the most accurate quartz watch in the world. I'll have to double check that, but I'm fairly sure they hold the record right now. So, you know, pretty impressive that on the manual side, they're also getting, you know, pretty high end. And look, Lejeune's, you know, Lejeune-Perret's work on the movement, they've done some stylistic things to the movement to really finish it at a higher level. So, you know, the rotor, the winding rotor has been skeletonized. You know, there's a multiple styles of finishing that they've put in there. As far as the actual watch itself, you know, it's a bit unassuming. It's a black dial grain finish watch. You got the Citizen logo applied and you got the Citizen Eagle, which I think they retained the Eagle really for their high end watch lines.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it's there for the day-to-day. It's definitely not there for the EcoDrive watches. This is really just for their high-end mechanicals. So yeah, I mean, retail sale of $6,000. Now, everyone is going to say, and I don't want to hear, you know, people howling into the wind over there that I'm not paying $6,000 for a Citizen. Look, you know, when Grand Seiko started moving its way into the market, people were saying I wasn't going to pay anything, you know, extravagant for a Seiko. And they've changed their mind. So I think Citizen is kind of taking a page out of Grand Seiko and saying, hey, you know,
yeah, the thing is,
you know, we can also compete at that level technically.
Right.
Now, whether you would want to have a watch with Citizen on it, you know, and pay for that is up to you. And I think, you know, that remains to be seen. But I think, you know, my opinion, you know, from a technical standpoint, I think it's justified. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's just more to do with the branding. Like if so, like, you know, Seiko, there's Seiko and then there's Grand Seiko. But Citizen, yes, it's just that maybe you should have rebranded the Citizen into a different line.
I agree with you. I agree with you. Or, you know, not call themselves a Grand Citizen, but, you know, some other line. And I think Citizen really, you know, Citizen Seiko, I think Citizen's technically the biggest watchmaker in the world. I think bigger than Seiko,
really?
Right? But I think so, yeah. I think they make more watches than Seiko does. And Citizen actually owns a lot of companies in the conglomerate that you wouldn't associate with them. They own Alpina. I didn't know that. They own Bulova.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, they're pretty big. Now, for their own Citizen-branded watches, the way they set up their lines and the way they kind of delineate what's what, it sort of doesn't make a lot of sense. And they don't do a very good job of delineating the lines, right? Like when we sit down and talk Seiko, like Presage, Prospects, you know, Grand Seiko, like we understand there's several lines.
Yeah, right? I know.
So like in several parts of the market, you can segment and kind of justify, okay, I would pay $5,000 for that watch. I would pay $500 for that watch. I would pay $50 for that watch, right? And you can justify it along the way. The problem is when everything is just labeled Citizen, it's difficult to draw those lines accurately.
Yes. Right?
Because anyone who wants to spend $6,000 on a watch at some level, right, doesn't want some punk with a $20 watch to have the same label as your watch.
Exactly.
Right. Even if the insides are completely different and the technology justifies it. And I think the technology absolutely justifies it.
Yeah,
right?
I think that's fine.
It's difficult. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's a very good movement, it looks like, right? Very highly accurate.
I really like the case design. And I think the bracelet looks really, really attractive.
I think it's an H-link nice watch. I mean,
it's done really well.
I actually like
the finishing dial. I like the dial. And the case finishing is done really well. That brush finishing looks really good. It's all in the same direction, top to bottom. It's really, really nice. And it's faceted around the actual, the bezel, you know, has a bit of a polish, I believe, on one angle. It's difficult to see.
Yeah, like
in the
on one of
pictures, but...
the chamfered edges, I guess, of the.
Correct, correct. Look at you, chamfered.
That's right.
That's an SAT word right there. Who is this guy? Who is this guy?
Very technical of me.
Very technical. Yeah. So I, you know,
I mean, as a watch itself, it's a win. I think just calling it a Citizen might be
holding it back.
It's kind of like the VW Phaeton when it came out. You know, $120,000.
Yes.
VW.
I do remember that. Who's gonna pay for the VW? You know, that expensive. And I kind of get that, right? I understand that because part of it is marketing, and part of it is also prestige, and that's kind of how people think about their money. You
know? I mean, how infuriating would it be for Seiko if Citizen called their high-end lineup Citizen Grand?
Yeah, I mean, it would be obvious what they were doing, right?
I mean, but they have obvious. Like, I mean, you know, like Arnold and Son, you know, Frederick Constant. They could have just added one of those.
Wait, Citizen owns Arnold and Son?
Yes, I believe so.
No.
They.
I gotta double check that.
I believe they do. While you check that, so the $6,000 price.
Yes, owned by Citizen Holdings. Wow. Okay. I am surprised. Did not know that. Okay.
I mean, they could have totally made this an Arnold and Son.
Yeah, but you know, I do think that they're trying to build Citizen itself, the Japanese brand, as you know, a competitor, right? They want to uphold Citizen, and I don't think it's that hard to just name it something else. Citizen, you know, I don't know, not Grand Citizen.
No, Citizen Grand. You know where the Grand
is. Citizen Grand
occurs after the
Grand.
Yeah,
I mean that's basically it. But we did cover a Citizen, high-end Citizen, a couple months ago, and it used the color dials, Japanese influence. It was very much like their snowflake, or you know, their version of the green dial, and it was beautiful. It had the Citizen Eagle in it. It was done really, really well. It was also like a couple grand, you know. And I think we had the same conversation about would you spend that much on a Citizen, and we reached the same conclusion, I think, if memory serves me right, is that the watch itself is really nice, but yeah, it's difficult to get past the brand, you know, unless they do something to really expand that brand and kind of get people comfortable to do that. So I don't know. Interesting. It's more a marketing problem than a technical problem, but you know, I guess it matters.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is a marketing issue to me than anything else. It's actually an attractive watch, I must say.
Yeah,
and I
really well.
All simplicity,
right, so,
you know, like with the dial, it's there's no date, no other complication, just a sub-second dial.
I actually thought you wouldn't like the Citizen logo as it was done there.
No, actually, I think that's fine. I think they did a really good job carving out the Citizen logo. Like, if you remember, there was that Bulova, which I kind of critiqued.
That's what I was thinking about. I think it was the Devil Diver that you didn't like the way the Bulova logo was attached.
Right. This one, they did a clean cut. Like it was like as if it was laser cut, you know, with the best of lasers.
Okay. Well, for $6,000.
You better come.
Yeah, it better be cut right. Okay. All right. So, So generally positive, but brand issues.
Yes.
Safe to
yes.
say?
Yes.
What do you got?
I'm going to talk about another integrated bracelet watch that is significantly cheaper, and that might pique your interest, honey. And that is the Tissot PRX, specifically the Tissot PRX 205.
Okay. This is a watch that's been very, very much buzzed about on the internet. So I'm glad we're covering it finally.
Yeah, so I was actually looking at what PRX actually stood for, and I believe the PR stands for Precise Robust. And the X stands for 10 atmospheres. So basically, it's diving water resistance, basically. So, you know, if you look at it, it's more of a very classic 1970s era looking watch. And it's based off, well, I guess, inspired by one of their Tissot C-Star watches. You know, the C-Star had a different array of watch designs and cases, but this was focused and inspired on one of them. And it's a simple three-hander with a date at 3 o'clock. And it's basically a no-nonsense. And you can get it in three flavors. You can get it in sunburst, like a sunburst dial in blue, or a sunburst dial in black. And I guess a bit more polished in like a white.
Okay. And in the white, it looks like rose gold hand
exactly.
markers.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, first of all, I'll say I like the case design a lot. It's a case that I find very attractive because it's I don't even know how to describe it, but it has an overhang beyond the bezel.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it from like a side view, it looks like a sandwich, you know, with it's split into three parts, kind of like, if I correct me if I'm wrong, kind of like your Zen, right?
I could see the resemblance, but I was gonna say the design, the highly angular case design, right, where it goes, you know, you have the round bezel, the round dial, and then outside the dial, the actual case is kind of almost a squarish cushion. It sounds insane, but you kind of have to see it. It is a cushion case, but it's kind of more angular and squarish. Now, if you look at the Hoyer Sport, okay, Hoyer Audi Sport, it has a very similar case design.
Yes.
It's like a flat, you know, squarish cushion case, okay? And then from there, you've got the integrated bracelet attached to it. And I find that very, very
interesting. It is. And I think...
I really like that. Yeah. And that's the reason I got the Dugina. It's the same case. I love that case.
Oh, new watch alert.
Yeah, new watch alert. Yeah, it's... I picked up a La Mania 5100 Dugina sports chronograph. It's the same case and movement as the Hoyer Sport, Audi Sport, which I love. I love that watch, and obviously that watch is super, super rare, and we'll talk about this in a standalone episode. But so I got the Dugina version, which is PVD, but the exact, you know, more or less the as close as you can get to that watch, the Audi Sport. It's actually in the shop now getting serviced. It may take a couple weeks.
Yeah, I think once you get it back, we should definitely do a short.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the watch was fully functional. It was just that the power reserve was abysmal.
Right.
So I had to constantly be shaking my hand, which is not very, effective. So, yeah.
Yeah,
so
you're basically doing Kermit hands all the time.
What's Kermit hand?
You know, Kermit the Frog, when he goes into a panic, he just shakes his hand up in the air.
I don't know.
Well, bad analogy, yeah. Apparently. I'll send you an example, you know.
Okay, I didn't grow up with Kermit. But yeah, and you know, this watch reminds me a lot of that case design, which I really like,
I find really attractive. The one thing I really like, this is one of the few watches, and I think it's maybe a better execution than even the Citizen itself, is where the design of the bracelet is very integral to the case of the watch, in the sense, if you look at how the case tapers, like in the cushion sense, right, at each end, the bracelet follows suit, and it tapers, the bracelet tapers as you go further down, you know, away from the watch.
Yeah.
It's very sleek, and it actually adds to, like, the slimness of the watch, because this is actually a pretty slim watch. It's only 10 millimeters thick, or 10.4 to be precise. And it's nicely sized. It's a 40 millimeter case. So,
it's very attractive. Yeah, it's very attractive.
Now, very brushed. You know, I think what helps the slimness of the watch is the movement.
Yeah.
And it is a quartz movement. So it might be a little off-putting to some, but I think for the price that you're getting, it's a pretty attractive offering for more of the aesthetic of the watch than anything.
What is the price?
$375.
Oh, wow. That's very nice. So, yeah, no, I think it's great. The problem with the sunburst dial blue and black is that white date window is pretty stark against it.
Yes.
You know, and if you get it in white... The white dial, it's less of an issue, but in the blue or black, it kind of stands out a little bit. So you're going to need to be okay with that, and you know, before you get involved in those other two colorways. But no, I think everything else is attractive. Now, you know, this is late breaking news, Sanj.
It is.
You know, you are You know, I'm in the Twitter world. I'm you know, looking at the TikToks, and I know what the kids are up to. I feel like you're a bit behind.
I still read the newspaper.
Still reading it's yeah, you're getting your telegraph, right? You're getting your news by telegraph. Anyway, Tissot PRX, there is a automatic version coming in June 2021. It's going to be outfitted with the Powermatic 80 movement, which is obviously a Swatch creation. And as far as I can tell, it comes in two flavors, either a black waffle dial or a blue dial. But it's an automatic movement. So, you know, if you have any issues of wearing a quartz, you know, that's kind of gone now. You have an automatic version.
Yes.
And the pricing here is still not that bad. It's the black and blue for 650
That's
euro.
not bad.
And there's a silver version, actually, with gold accents at 690. It's not bad.
That's actually
Not bad at
very,
all.
very attractive.
Yeah. With the Powermatic 80, it's a very different watch, and it's got a you know a exhibition case back, which is, and it's finished really well, actually. You know, the movement looks beautiful, and I don't know about you, but I would go for that waffle black
I
dial,
would go
that
for the
black
black
waffle
dial
dial. I
too,
think
yeah.
it's really attractive. It really pops. You know, unlike the other quartz version, this black actually has a bit of definition. It really plays with the
If
light really
anything,
well.
the waffle dial on the Powermatic 80 is it's not much to, you know, like it's literally another black dial, but the way it's, you know, executed, it's way more vintagey, if that's even a word, than
Yeah,
the
no, I agree.
Sunburst.
I
I think the
agree.
Sunburst
I
brings
agree.
a little bit of modern flair to it.
Yes. No, I agree. This looks like something straight out of the 70s. And I love it. I mean, you know, I've consistently said that I'm not a fan of just three-hand date watches, right? It's got to have a complication. It's got to have a complication. This watch is close to an exception, just because the design is so funky and it's so out there, right? That it could kind of stand
Yeah,
on its
the
own.
only thing is that I think this one has a bit more polishing around the circumference of the bezel, like the bezel of the watch. I mean, if you compare that to, let's
Okay.
say, the quartz one, I think.
Yeah, it's tough to tell in the pictures, but I think you're right. I think you're right.
And
Yeah, I think you're right,
actually,
actually. Yeah.
that's where I think the quartz has a bit of an advantage because the watch.
Advantage,
Yeah, to me
really.
it is because it's, you know, much of the watch is purely brushed, and you know, I like to see the way they applied the brush, you know, the single direction, you know, it's very uniform, and having that polished circumference on the PRX Powermatic 80 just kind of spoils the look of it to me, at least a little bit. But I mean, whether you go for the quartz or the Powermatic, both are excellent choices.
Both are excellent. I like the automatic, actually. I like the polish. I think for people who want a slice of that Audemars Piguet Royal Oak thing, the Tissot PRX automatic is an affordable way to
You
kind
know what?
of
Yeah,
live that
I can see
lifestyle.
that. I mean, it's what,
That's the way to go.
650 euro, which is basically not even cheaper, like probably 1/20th of the price.
Exactly. Exactly. And it looks fantastic. I really like that. So, not something in my usual wheelhouse, but I've got to say, I really think they did a good job here.
I mean,
So,
it's a black dial watch, Tommy. That's definitely in your wheelhouse.
that is in my wheelhouse. Well, so yeah, you know, I don't think this is the end of a trend. I'm excited to see maybe Heuer bring integrated bracelet watches back. Maybe Heuer chronographs, you know. I don't know who the heck is running Tag Heuer. I don't know how they're not dipping into that whole slew of 80s chronographs that haven't gotten reissues. I really think they need to get on that. You know, so I think this is the beginning of a trend, not the end of it. So Tissot and Citizen may be one of the early adopters, but I think there's going to be more coming.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, should we move on to closing notes? I think you and I each have
Yes, we
one.
do. And it's actually related to aerospace in some.
Both are aerospace. Yeah. So I'll kick off. The first one is an article by Forbes saying that the U.S. Air Force just admitted that the F-35 stealth fighter has failed, which is pretty telling. So, you know, there was a hearing on the Hill. A U.S. Air Force officer was talking about how, you know, they need to start developing a cheap fighter to accompany, to be in a high-low mix. Basically, you would have these high-end fighters, and you know, you would have this cheap fighter who would make up the numbers that, you know, the, you know, we wouldn't go bankrupt building all these fighters to make up the numbers, because the F, and it's a failure because the F-35 was supposed to be that cheap fighter.
Yeah, I mean, it was,
so, you know, a generation ago the F-22 was supposed to be the high-end air dominance fighter, but you'd have a lot of these cheap F-35 stealth fighters who would make up the numbers, and you know, we wouldn't go broke fielding these. Now, after, you know, 15-20 years of fielding these things and working through the design kinks, it's basically, it looks like the Air Force is throwing its hands up in the air and saying, okay, this thing is never going to be cheap enough for us to play this role, and they're going to need to develop something else.
I mean, the brief of the F-35 was so broad, you know, it had to fulfill so many mission criteria elements that it just lost the plot, basically.
There is an irony in fighter development, and for aviation fans, you know, I think this should remind you of the F-4. You know, the F-4 was a Navy, Air Force. I think the Marines also fielded it. And when you have, so the pitch for fighters like this, programs like this, is that if every service uses it, you get a lot of commonality of parts and a lot of efficiencies, right? So you don't have to build, you don't have to get spare parts for 3-4 different platforms. You just get spare parts for one platform. But the problem is every single service has their own unique demands on what that plane needs to do, right? So like a carrier landing plane has to have stronger landing gear, and it's got to be built to a little tougher specification to
do that. It has to have like Air Force Ones, at least on the F-35 Navy version, it has larger wings to, you know, for low speed maneuverability to land on the carrier, which I believe it folds up, right?
I mean, I think Navy fighters almost always have to have fold-up wings just to
correct
the space constraints of a carrier. Yeah. So then the Marine one had to have some kind of VTOL capability because it was supposed to replace the Harrier. So they had to build this whole VTOL engine thing. We've talked about this before, but it, you know, it's insane. It's in itself would have been a massive project, but that is just for one variant of the F-35,
yeah,
right? And then you got the Air Force version, which is just a straight, you know, gunfighter. And, you know, that is supposed to just be the dominance, the air dominance fighter. It doesn't need to do anything else, but that's the baseline. So, you know, when you have all these variations, the commonality amongst the variations becomes lower and lower the more you let each service tailor make the fighter. So any efficiency you may have had by picking one fighter is gone, because end of the day, you're ending up with three.
Yeah, I mean, the F-35 is a masterpiece of engineering. Don't get me wrong. It's just that it just tries to do, it's, you know, it's, it, it tried to do too much, in my opinion. Basically, it's like taking, making a vehicle, right? You know, like the Air Force is the sports car, you know, the high end, you know, the Corvette. And then trying to convert that Corvette into a carrier, which is basically, I don't know, maybe let's say an SUV. And another one, you know, vertical takeoff and landing, which is another form of vehicle. So you can't do three things on the same platform.
It never works out this way. And I'm fascinated that, you know, after the F-4 program, nobody thought about that when they greenlit the F-35, because the experience, even the F-4 program had a lot of issues when it was first adopted. In fact, it was delivered, I mean, not related to necessarily development, but at that time it was delivered famously without guns. So they had to build a whole other version with a gun in it because they found that the missiles weren't accurate enough. But, you know, it rarely ever works out this way. And usually the programs just go ridiculously over budget. So, I mean, the F-35 was a $1.5 trillion program, right? Not to say that every one of it went into building fighters. There's also R&D and service costs and whatever built in. But still, that's a lot of money to throw into a program that now you're going to have to go back and say, actually, we're going to need a replacement for this program.
I wouldn't say a replacement. It's just like another line of fighter aircraft to supplement, you know. But
Well, I would say replacement, because this was supposed to be the cheap fighter program, and now you need another cheap fighter program because this didn't turn out to be a cheap fighter program, right? So, I mean, it's an admission of failure. I don't know, the fighter itself may be very well performing, but for the role that it was supposed to play, it is not playing that role, because it just the budget constraints, the pricing never got to an appropriate part. And not to mention the serviceability and all these other issues that it's still plagued with, 5-10 years after it's gone operational. So,
to me, it's just a little bit of a shame that, the only I think 183 F-22s were built. I think there was some regret to not keep the tooling and restart the line.
I don't know. I'm of the mind that maybe stealth doesn't make any sense, because I think stealth is temporary, right? I mean, if you go back in time, you think of the F-117, right? The F-117 was a stealth bomber, right? The Nighthawk. And the Serbs ended up shooting it down, right? With Russian help during the Kosovo War, if I remember serves me right. And I think the idea to think about stealth is it's a constant cold war. It's a technical cold war between two sides, between the side with the SAM and the radar versus the fighter, right? And anytime, you have a technical battle like this, it's a matter of time until one side is able to detect it and break the code and find a way to detect the fighter, right? So it doesn't make sense to build something that's going to last for 30, 40 years when you may only be stealthy for the first 10 years or so, right? You're better off, approaching the problem differently. Like Saab approaches the problem differently, right? They've got the Gripen.
Right.
It's not stealthy, but like they've figured out ways to use the Gripen in an environment where it can be detected and still kind of do its job, right? And maybe that's the right approach, and maybe what the U.S. Air Force is going to do is build, or perhaps they should just buy the Gripen. It's a cheaper platform, and it could make up the numbers where, you couldn't.
That's never going to happen, right?
No, it's never going to happen. No, I mean, it's jobs lost. They're never going to do that. But I think they should, right? I mean, keep the F-35, keep the F-22. But for your numbers, it would make sense to build something like that. I think,
Let it be known that you're into outsourcing here.
It wouldn't be the first time. I mean, the Harrier technically was a British project that the U.S. got involved with, right? So it wouldn't be that crazy. But yeah, I mean, I hear you. It's fairly unlikely, but just an idea.
I mean, maybe you can just pack the aircraft. I think the F-18, the F-18G for Growler, which came equipped with radar jamming capabilities. Electronic jamming, that may be the approach that could be taken. I don't know.
I mean, the F-18 is getting long in the tooth itself, right? As far as the
heavily capable,
the design.
I mean, if you look at Boeing,
it's at the end of its life.
Iterations of the F-15 or proposing it, right? I think they have the F-15 EX.
Yeah, they're doing this. Yeah, exactly.
Still highly,
I mean, all those designs are. These are fighters that first flew in the 70s. So
it goes to show that
it's time
that some of the stuff that came out of the 70s and 60s, or let's say during the Cold War, were really well thought of, pieces of platform. The F-18 is still F-15 is a very high capable air superiority aircraft, right? I mean, I don't think one has ever been shot down by enemy. No,
I don't think so. I don't think so. Yeah. So yeah, it's very impressive. Yeah.
I mean, we can keep on babbling on this, but yeah, this article kind of highlights that. Yeah,
it's a good read. Yeah, yeah. Give it a shot. And it's a huge program. It's more a money thing than a technical thing. It's also a technical thing. Obviously, the fighter is not up to snuff in any way, shape, or form. It's a shame, but yeah, the serviceability issues with it continue. But yeah, I mean, when you think of the amount of money that's been committed to this thing, it's unbelievable that we're back to square one.
Yeah, it's an indirect admission.
It's an indirect admission. Exactly. All right, Sanj, what do you got?
So I'm going to be talking about another very expensive program, which I think we talked about, you know, brilliant piece of...
Yeah. Ad nauseum.
Brilliant piece of engineering, extremely sophisticated, but conceptually flawed in a sense. So it's two articles, one referring the other. So the one I initially found was, you know, the man who tried to stop the space shuttle Challenger launch and expose NASA's cover-up. So that is Alan MacDonald. He, I believe, was a director, engineering director or so at Morton Thiokol. He refused to sign the approval form, basically, during the Challenger launch because, you know, he stuck to his gut and also, you know, technical knowledge of the fact that the O-rings might fail. And, you know, this eventually and tragically happened the next day, basically, right? It was basically the Morton executives that kind of overrode his rejection, basically, and said, yeah, we'll launch it and give the approval. You know, during the Challenger hearings, he basically stood up and said that, you know, he refused to sign it. And you know, the NPR article, which the Jalopnik article referenced to, and we'll put that there on the show notes as well. You know, during the hearing, I believe the senator even called him up because he was like, he stood up. And said, like, hey, can you say, you know, what I believe that you heard? And the Morton Thiokol executives were not happy about that, you know, when he did that. And they actually demoted him. Yeah. But then, you know, the members of Congress, you know, basically threatened and said.
I just want to give a shout out. My local senator, Senator Ed Markey, who was then in Congress, introduced a resolution in the House to forbid Thiokol from getting future NASA contracts, given the punishment that they did to MacDonald. And then they relented, and he was promoted and put in charge of the effort to redesign the...
Right, and he was even promoted to vice president.
So it's because of Markey. Yep.
So I think, you know, he was, if anything, you know, he was regarded for making decisions based on ethics and ethical business decisions. And you know, after he retired, he kind of, you know, went on a speaking route and kind of professed his thoughts and ways of making such decisions.
If you haven't seen Challenger Final Flight on Netflix, I can't recommend it enough. He is part of that documentary. He does give interviews for it. So you can kind of hear kind of what his journey was and, you know, the dramatization of that story. It's pretty,
yeah.
Pretty
interesting. And, you know, the one thing I want to take away is, you know, a quote from, I think, one of the universities, I guess an employee, Meyer. And he says that, and I'm going to quote, what we should remember about Al MacDonald is he would often stress his laws of the seven R's. It was always do the right thing for the right reason at the right time with the right people, and you will have no regrets for the rest of your life. That's kind of a powerful quote, actually.
Words to live by. Yeah.
So.
It's you know, he's a very brave person, you know, and it's sad that he wasn't listened to, but you know, he was eventually the person that helped get the shuttle.
Exactly, and
after. You know,
he wrote a book, which I'm pretty interested in getting it myself. It's called Truth, Lies, and O-Rings, Inside the Space Shuttle Challenger Disaster. Apparently, it's a well, you know, regarded book. So,
yeah, great. Well, I think that's a great note. Definitely check that out. All right, Sanj, I think that's all we have for today. We have covered quite the gamut, my friend.
We went all over the place, but you know what? That's what a podcast is.
That's what a not so short is all about. All right. Well, thanks again for joining us for another short from the Land Jam podcast. Give us a follow. give us a like, give us a review on iTunes if you can.